Frank Fascino Jr. and I got together a few years ago at a conference, and he'd been working on the Flatwoods Monster case. Lo and behold, there were the articles where the Air Force instructed its pilots to shoot them down if they don't land when ordered to do so. And I hadn't known a lot of this stuff.
Yeah.
Because it wasn't in the Times, the Washington Post, and so forth. So what I'm saying is this is an aspect of the whole problem that hasn't been considered. That's why I recommend Frank's book, Shoot Them Down. Three of the pilots were people who'd had over 100 combat missions in Korea where they were mixed trying to shoot them down.
Yeah.
They survived that and they come back to the States and they crashed.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, Banal of America Audio with your host, Tim Banal.
No commercials, no subscriptions, no networks, no rules, and at the end of the day, my friends, no comparison. Welcome to another edition of BOA Audio Season 8 Live. And as usual here, we are broadcasting from the outskirts of Boston, Massachusetts, which is home to the world champion Boston Red Sox. I just want to get that in there. It's been quite a month here in the Massachusetts area. We're all very thrilled. Congratulations to the Sox. Thank you for an awesome ride. And we're getting ready for an awesome ride to take place in just a few moments. We're doing another first-time guest here on the program. Our guest is Frank Fascino. He is the author of a couple of groundbreaking and outstanding books, The Braxton County Monster, as well as Shoot Them Down, The Flying Saucer Air Wars of 1952. And I owe a big thanks to Alfred Lemberg and Jeremy Vaney, both for recommending Frank Fascino. I can't believe those two guys worked in tandem on this one. But a long time ago, Alfred Lemberg wrote to me and suggested Frank, and somehow it got lost in the shuffle. And then recently, Jeremy Vaney also recommended Frank, and I said, everybody keeps recommending Frank Fascino. And I had Stan Friedman on the show 5 years ago, and that's where you heard those clips here that began the program, and he was raving about Frank's work. So it's long, long, long overdue that we got him on the program. Frank, welcome to BOA Audio. Thank you for being patient enough and finally arriving here on BOA Audio. We're really looking forward to it.
Hey, Tim, glad to be here. Didn't we actually meet in Las Vegas a few years ago?
I believe we did, yeah. We met.
Yeah, it was kind of brief. It was kind of a busy conference.
It was, it was quite the event. Yeah, it was a good time, though. Yeah, that was at the Crash. I guess Crash Conference, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
Second
one. Right.
I think it was 06, and it was in Vegas. It was quite the happening. I remember your presentation. You had a film that you were working on.
Right.
So I guess, you know, to catch people up to speed, we usually do this with the first-time guests, even though we're live and everything. It's, this is for posterity. You know, 100 years from now, somebody could be listening to this, and they're going to need this background information. So tell us a little bit about Frank Fascino. Who are you? How did you get interested in UFOs? And really, you know, how did that interest lead you into this research into the Braxton County Monster and, of course, the Flying Saucer Air Wars of 52?
Well, Tim, about a little over 20 to 21 years ago, I was visiting some relatives in Braxton County, relatives in Flatwoods and Frametown. And I actually started looking into crop circles because there was a lot of crop circles appearing throughout Braxton County. And some of them were actually on my cousin's property. So I started photographing them, taking samples, and, you know, documenting all of these crop circle rings and patterns that were strewn throughout the area. And I was told about a few other ones, so I documented them throughout Braxton County, and I was running around up there with my cousin. And at the time, I was living in Connecticut. That was before I moved to Florida. And I was put in contact with Colin Andrews. And I shared all my data with Colin. And, excuse me, at that point, I didn't know about the Flatwoods Monster. I was making trips to West Virginia and documenting the crop circle rings when I had a chance. So I'm talking back and forth for a while with Colin about this, and we were trading notes. And in the meantime, I had found out about this case called the Braxton County Monster.
Mm-hmm.
And so I kind of stumbled into it. Somebody told me about this. You know, well, you know, this is one aspect of the UFO stuff here with crop circle rings, and there's tons of UFO sightings up there, but the reports rarely came out of the mountains. And I started looking into this case, the Braxton County Monster or Flatwoods Monster,
right,
also known as. And it wasn't easy at first looking into this case. It intrigued me more the way the people reacted when you said, you know, the Flatwoods Monster. People kind of backed off and wouldn't talk about it. You know, it was like a standoff, and I'm like, oh, this is crazy. What the hell happened here back in 52? The people are still acting weird about this. So I started looking into the case through different periodicals, magazines, books, basically anything I can get my hands on. And I continued going back and forth from Connecticut into West Virginia researching the Flatwoods case. And I started going to different libraries, and I basically combed the whole state of West Virginia, looking through archives, going to museums, libraries. It was unbelievable. I spent years going back and forth and putting this story together. In the meantime, I was put in touch with Kathleen May, who was the primary witness involved in the Flatwoods Monster incident. And over the course of several years, it took me a little time to actually get in with the people and warm up to each other, because they were very standoffish about this whole incident. And it was hard. And even though I had family up there, I'm still considered an outsider.
Right, yeah.
And when outsiders go up into the mountains up there, it's very hard to break in. I remember the first time I met Stanton Friedman, it was back in 1996. I met him in Gulf Breeze at a convention, and we started talking about Flatwoods. I'll never forget, he looked at me. He says, how the hell did you get into those mountains? UFO researchers have been trying to get in there for years. And I told him, I said, I have family there, which made it a little bit easier, but not much. But I did have a little head start on that.
Yeah.
But I basically had to prove myself, Tim, to the people up there of, you know, my sincerity. And I wasn't there to make a joke out of the Flatwoods case like people have done for so many years. When this happened back in 52, it was taken very seriously at the onset, but it turned around drastically. And intelligence was actually up there. There were Air Force officials, you know, that all were covert. And what happened is the media got hold of this thing, and they just made a joke out of it. So the whole community basically shut down and stopped talking about it. So it was hard for people to get in there to actually talk with the people who were involved in it.
Yeah.
And when I started just over 20 years ago, a lot of the key witnesses were still alive, because you have to remember, this is over 60 years ago at this point.
Yeah, exactly. Last year was like the 60th, right?
Right. It's 61 years now. And back at that point in the early 90s, I went to film and video school, and I learned how to work high-end cameras. I had some good teachers. And I was going back and forth. I had moved to Florida. And then I was going back and forth, and I was actually videotaping the different people.
Mm-hmm.
And so I have all of this archived, and I put together a little 37-minute documentary that's on YouTube right now, and it shows clips and highlights.
Nice, nice.
The different witnesses. So it was kind of fun. It was a lot of years put into this, but I think, as far as I know, I have the longest investigation into this case in history.
I would imagine, yeah. And folks can check out flatwoodsmonster.com. I believe there's a link right to the video on right where you can get to the page. So they should definitely check that out. Well, let me circle back a little bit, because you reminded me, I was looking at your info, that you did start out on the crop circle investigation. Now, we're going to get deep into Flatwoods and the 52 saucer war, but tell me just a little bit about, because I never even considered I know there's American crop circles, but I didn't even realize that maybe it was big enough that you could actually look into them and investigate them at any depth. So tell me a little bit about what you did looking at those and, you know, what's that all about?
Well, what happened is my cousin purchased property up there quite a few years ago, and the property had sat and it was stagnant for several years. Nobody bought or had bought the property. They didn't touch it. So he had the property for a little while, and then he kind of figured out what the hell was going on because he was seeing UFOs and saucers all over the place, and it was kind of common. And right in the area of Frametown, there was a particular incident that happened in the early 90s that went nationwide, and a flying saucer had flown into one of my cousin's neighbor's backyards, and it was reported, and I think it was on the Maury Povich show.
Oh, boy.
Well, anyways, this was a big story, and that was one of the first major stories to come out of mountains in years. And the more I started going up and visiting everybody and talking to the locals up there, it was kind of like common, except they didn't want to talk about it. The people up there went through the Flatwoods Monster case, and they're like, oh, we're not going through all this crap again.
Right, right.
We kind of learned our lesson. But this one particular story went nationwide, and they ended up botching it up. And, you know, they edited things poorly, which is seems to be common practice with television. But anyways, I got to be friends with the people who were involved in this case. And I was introduced to different people throughout the mountains and throughout Braxton County. And it was very common to see UFOs. And at first, you know, I took it with a grain of salt. And, you know, I would kind of snicker and laugh at the people. And they would say, well, don't laugh at us. And, you know, go up there in the mountains certain times of the year, certain times of the evening, you know, and there was actually a lot of daytime sightings, and you're going to see this stuff. And it's like, son of a bitch, there we were. I was up there, and I saw myself, and I actually watched them for hours on end. And I went up there with a lot of different friends and family members, and some of the photographs that I took are actually on my website. In the Paratopia area, I have a few good shots of some UFOs in flight and making directional changes. And there's some shots of the crop circle. So there was a lot of stuff going on in this one region of Frametown and the outskirts.
Yeah.
And Frametown is actually, if people are familiar with the story, the follow-up story to Flatwoods, where the reptilian was seen by George Nathowski.
Okay.
The day after the Flatwoods case, all of this stuff happened right in that area, and it's still going on.
Makes you wonder what's behind that. You know, what's the source of that interest? Let's say, you know.
Well, when you talk to the locals up there,
yeah,
this has been going on up there since the 40s.
Hmm.
And when I did my first book tour back in 2004, I was going all throughout West Virginia, and my hub was in Charleston. I did a lot of book signings throughout the state, and it was very common to have the people telling me about stories that were taking place going back into the 40s and 50s up there. It's kind of funny. There was even one particular incident I'll never forget. This guy walked up to me with his wife, and they had been married for years. And the guy started telling me this unbelievable close encounter case where he saw a bronze craft that was shaped like a disc with a dome on the outskirts of Charleston, where the interstate is. There wasn't where the interstate is now. Back then, there wasn't an interstate.
Right.
But in that particular area, and he's going into explicit detail, and his wife looked at him. And she says, we've been married for like 55 years, and you never told me that story. So I've heard a lot of different stuff like that. But the locals in Braxton County seem to think there's some type of a vortex up there.
Okay. Yeah.
That's the opinion. There's some type of a vortex because they're always seen in one particular region.
Yeah.
And I've seen them up there quite often myself where you see them, and then they just disappear, and then they show up over there. And I've seen, oh, God, as many as a dozen at a time flying around in patterns throughout the sky. And like I said, if you go on my website, you could see a few of the pictures I was able to get.
Now, regarding the crop circles, there's sort of this debate, you know, messages versus sort of like, artifacts of a UFO landing or whatever, a UFO incident, you know what I mean? Sort of like a trace case, sort of an effect, if you will. Mm-hmm. What was your take on what you saw for crop circles? What was the makeup of these?
What they actually were, Tim, is they weren't crop circles per se like the ones you see in England.
Right.
They were more like crop circle rings, and they were kind of like banded rings, and they were all over my cousin's property. And actually, he flipped out and went crazy because he had purchased the farm, and he was grooming it up because of, you know, shabby. And he walks out one day and he sees like 60 of them across his property. And he's swearing, calls me up on the phone. He says, got to get your ass up here and document these things and blah, blah, blah. So I went up there with a video camera, you know, and still cameras. And I had all my equipment and I took soil samples and all different stuff. And I gave all that stuff to Colin Andrews. I'll make a long story short, a couple of years later, somebody from Collins' camp had contacted me, and the same formation of crop circle rings had appeared in England.
Oh, weird.
Yeah, it was a couple of years later. And, yeah, that was kind of spooky, you know, West Virginia and England. He had some type of a database system, like fingerprinting, where they cross-reference, and they had popped. So you have crop circles in England and in Braxton County that were basically the same.
Makes you, I wonder if that connects somehow with this portal idea that maybe, you know, maybe that's the doorway of sorts, or the effect of the doorway, or who knows.
And then they eventually went away. The whole grass area basically filled back in and it grew back in after a few years, and then they appeared again. About six years later, and I went back up there and I documented all of those and forwarded those to Colin. So there's definitely something going on up there.
Yeah, I'm going to presume it's, you know, not to be pejorative, but it's kind of in the middle of nowhere. So we can assume that these aren't tricksters or pranksters running around on your cousin's farm. Why would they go
all the way? One thing I learned, you do not go onto somebody's property in West Virginia when they have a no trespassing sign because you'll get your ass shot off. I was warned of that right off the bat. They say, well, you're kind of a city boy. Just be careful with walking around up here. And you don't walk around somebody else's property up there when it's posted. No trespassing, no hunting.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
and certainly
disappear.
No crop circle making. So they would not be a fan of that. All right. Well, that's really weird and interesting, the crop circle aspect of this, because, you know, it's so bizarre and so unique in general. But let's, I guess, move into the Flatwoods story. You've been doing this for 20 years. You've been looking at this for 20 years. Like I said, we're sort of reaching an audience here that's not only listening at the very moment, but could be listening, you know, 50 to 100 years from now. So, and I like to think of the program as sort of the paranormal program of record, so we document all this stuff as best as possible. So give us the thumbnail on the Flatwoods monster case, the Braxton monster case. Give us sort of a thumbnail on what went down there in September 1952 so we can catch everybody up to speed on this story.
Well, we'll go back to when I went into Flatwoods for the first time. I was with my cousin. We drove into Flatwoods in his truck, and there's this big sign hanging on the side of the road, "Welcome to Flatwoods, home of the Green Monster." And I'm like, wow, this is wild. And we drove into town, jumped out of the truck, and we were over at the school playground, and we were walking around talking to people there. You know, these are country folk. They're walking their dogs, just hanging out. You know, you don't lock your doors up there. You really don't have to. And we're just shooting the breeze with some of the locals, and that's when they started looking at me like I was nuts when I was saying, you know, what do you know about the Flatwoods Monster?
Right, and this is like the early 90s, right?
Yeah, this was just over 20 years ago, 21 years ago. And I didn't know anything about the case, and I started talking to some different people up there, and, you know, they just kind of laughed at it. And then I started looking into it a little bit deeper. When I got back to Connecticut, Yale Library, all New Haven, Bridgeport Libraries, and I was hitting every place looking up the stuff for September 12th, 1952. And I was going to the different bookstores throughout Connecticut and in New York, used bookstores, and I was looking at New Age. And I started finding out that there was no two stories about the Flatwoods Monster case that were the same. The story had become so convoluted, it was unbelievable. Here I have a collection of books, magazines, and every single one was different. And I saw what had happened, how the people were made fun of, and how they just shut down. So I kept going back up there, and I eventually was put in touch with Kathleen May, the primary witness. And she was sick on and off for several years. And at the point when I started looking into this, she was very sick. So I just basically did interviews with her and talked to her over the telephone. And I was going to different people's homes. They were like, go talk to this one. He was involved. This one saw this. So every trip up there, I'm banging on doors, calling people up, being a pain in the neck, and trying to find out what happened. Well, Kathleen kind of coordinated everything
right.
and would call the people ahead because I was having trouble getting in there. There was a couple little instances of myself going into town, and I learned I don't walk around with a $50,000 camera slung over my shoulder with a tripod and walk into like a breakfast cafe because, you know, there'll be 30, 40 people in there clinging to forks and blah, 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 and they all stop. And they all stare at you and look at you, and you hear them like, who the hell is this guy?
Yeah.
You know, and I didn't fit in. And so I started traveling more with my cousin instead of going by myself because I didn't like going through the mountains by myself. You hear a lot of crazy stories.
I can imagine, yeah. Now, just to jump in for a moment, now, given that you've dedicated 20 years to really setting the record straight about this story, you're kind of like more... I won't go so far as to say beloved, but are you more accepted by the locals there now? Or are they kind of like, that's Frank, he's on our side?
Yeah, actually, the whole community took me in. It wasn't overnight,
yeah.
But I basically vindicated the people, and
nice.
You know, the proof is in my books. And it's funny, whenever I don't drive up there anymore, that's too long of a drive from Florida, I'm over there. But flying in and out of Huntington and out of Charleston, it's just funny whenever I landed in the airports, the people all walk up to me and they recognize me because I've been on the news up there probably 100 different times, and everybody recognizes me and comes over and shoots the breeze with me. So it's kind of cool. More people know me up there than in Florida.
I can imagine, yeah.
You know, so basically I was accepted up there.
Nice.
Because I kind of... For lack of better terms, I kind of represented them almost as an attorney because there were so many people have tried to beat this story down, and they can't because I come back with the proof and the evidence because I have a ton of government documentation.
Yeah,
I have firsthand eyewitness account, and I have the Colonel Levin interview. So, and then the main thing is all the Project Blue Book documents.
Mm-hmm.
I have a couple pounds of paper just for September 12th and 13th, 1952.
Oh, wow.
And that is where everything just went crazy when I started looking outside of Flatwoods. It's kind of funny, Tim. A couple, about 3 years ago, I was in Charleston, and I was bringing different souvenirs and different things back, and my suitcase was over the 50-pound limit. It was 52 pounds.
Yeah.
Right? And they said, you're going to have to take something out of there, Mr. Ficino. And I went over, and I had my Project Blue Book September 12th and 13th sheets.
Yeah.
And I pulled it out, and it went down to 50 pounds. So I actually, honest to God, I actually have 2 pounds worth of documents for Project Blue Book that have to do with the Flatwoods case and what happened throughout the United States on that one night. And September 13th, there's a handful of documents. So there's a lot of stuff going on. That's a true story, too. So I just carried that Project Blue Book
paperwork
on is my carry-on.
Okay. Nice. Holy crap. All right, so taking us back to your investigation and everything, how did everything unfold that night, I guess, so we can catch people up?
Well, we have this story where a bunch of kids had seen a fireball go over the elementary school playground,
mm-hmm.
Of Flatwoods. And one of the key points here, Tim, is Flatwoods is the geographical dead bullseye center of the state of West Virginia. And if you look at a map of the eastern United States and mid-Atlantic area, Flatwoods is actually just about 200 miles due west of Washington, D.C., which is going to come into play later.
Okay.
So basically, if you stood in Washington at a high point and looked west 200 miles, you're going to see Flatwoods.
All right.
Okay?
Yeah.
And that's a key point. Well, anyways, I was September 12, 52. It was just before 7:30 that night, and a bunch of kids were out playing football, pickup ball on playground, and this gigantic flaming object, it was basically shaped like an egg, and was about 16 to 18 feet high and approximately 32 feet long. And it flew from the north, headed south. It flew over a mountaintop at very low level, flew over the school, made a 45-degree angle turn, and flew across the Route 4 and landed up on a mountaintop on a Bailey Fisher farm across the street. So the kids see this thing go over. Some of them are yelling, it's a UFO, it's a saucer. Some are yelling, it's a meteor, the little kids. And these kids, you know, were ranged. You know, they were average about 10 years old up to 18.
Okay.
And they were all screaming, let's go check this thing out. And they ran up the street approximately a mile to the house of Kathleen May. And Kathleen May's house is on Depot Street, and it sits just in back of the train depot. This was the access road that actually led up onto the Bailey Fisher farm. So what we have here is this bunch of kids running into Kathleen's house. Two of the boys in the group were Freddie May and Eddie May. Eddie May was 13, and his kid brother Freddie was 11. I worked with Freddie and Kathleen very close over the years. They were the ones who really went above and beyond to help me with this and got me connections with other people in the community.
Mm-hmm.
So these kids go screaming in the front door. Something landed up on the back hill at a Fisher farm. And Kathleen May, she was a beautician. She worked in town. She had just got home, and she had her 1950s era little beautician outfit. She had a hat on with her uniform. And the oldest boy in the group, Gene Lemon, that was her first cousin. And Gene, being the oldest one, he was kind of in charge of getting all of the kids together.
Right.
And he went up onto the farm with Kathleen May. Well, some of the kids chickened out and went home because they were scared. And in the end, we actually have Kathleen May, Gene Lemon. We had 14-year-old Neil Munley, Teddy Neal. He was 13, so, as well as Eddie. We had Freddie May, 11, Ronald Shaver, 10. They were on the playground, and a little kid from the neighborhood had heard the commotion, and his name was Tommy Heyer, and he was 6 years old. So we have a bunch of boys between 6 and 18 years old. There were seven of them. Kathleen May was 32 years old.
Oh, wow.
It's dusk, and here goes this wagon train of West Virginia folk up into the back to check out what had happened.
Yeah.
And the layout of the land, this is very important because this kind of gives you an overview of the farm, okay?
Mm-hmm.
There's three sections to the farm, Tim. The first section to the farm is a big, wide-open pasture field.
Okay.
And you walk across the field, and over to the left-hand side of the property facing north in the corner of the property is a big, gigantic gate. And this, it's a steel gate, and this separated the first pasture of the farm from the middle pasture.
All right.
The middle pasture of the farm is a big gully, and it sweeps down from the left-hand side down to the right, and there was woods on the left-hand side. That's the number two pasture.
Mm-hmm.
The third pasture was where this thing had touched down and landed way up on the back part of the Fisher property.
Okay.
And that's where the boy saw this thing stop in midair. It didn't come down, you know, in a trajectory where it crashed and impacted into the earth. The thing kind of hovered and just dropped straight to the ground below the tree lines.
Like a landing, almost.
Yeah, right. And this thing was on fire, flames, there's pieces falling off of it, and it kind of stopped and just dropped below the horizon line of where, their point of view, because they're down in the valley looking up higher. So they're walking up onto the first pasture of the farm. And I worked close with Kathleen for several years and interviewed her several times and a lot of audio and video recordings, and I always took notes when I got together with her. One of the main things that Kathleen was always talking about is she was starting to head up onto the hill when the first pasture. When she got across the crest, she said there was a big, gigantic, purplish flare, and the whole farm lit up. She wasn't on the farm. She was going up the walkway, which was like a dirt path, and she saw the flare out in the backside of the farm, and she didn't know what it was. They cleared the crest of the hill where the walkway was. It's like a driveway now. And as they started walking into the path, they were looking, and the kids were pointing. That's where it went down. It was way back there.
Mm-hmm.
So the whole group walk across the first pasture. In the meantime, there was a collie from the nearby neighborhood that had joined the group. It was a big collie dog. And Freddie May reminded me of the size of this dog. It was big. Freddie had a dog, and Gene Lemon also had a dog. They were from the same litter. They were little mid-sized dogs. So we have this group of eight people, two adults leading the group, Kathleen and Gene Lemon. They're walking across the path, and this big German, collie, walks across, and it's hanging out with them.
Right.
They got up to the first fence, and they opened the fence up. They all passed through it, and they closed it up behind them. Now, as they're walking up a little bit further, which is actually east at this point, the woods are to the left-hand side of them.
Okay.
And their path starts ascending and going up because it's going towards the back. And over to the right-hand side is where that gully is. And to the right-hand side of the path, there was brush. And a lot of the kids couldn't see up above that point because this brush was surrounding the area. The farm was unkept.
Mm-hmm.
And they saw something flashing out in the distance. Now, at that point there, what had actually happened is when the craft touched down in the back, Tim, it actually relocated and settled itself and nestled in the corner of the farm. And there was a small pear tree orchard back then in the 50s.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing was kind of tucked away in back of these pear trees. Some of the kids saw this thing intermittently flashing. The older boys, they could see up over the brush. They saw this thing flashing.
Yeah.
And the kids are very adamant about, we saw up there. So they have their eyes focused, looking straight up ahead.
Mm-hmm.
So as they start moving up this, it's basically like it's still the same. Now it's a old dirt path. They called it a wagon path. And they're starting to ascend and walk up towards the back. And they noticed this smell, and it was like a sulfur smell, and it was coming from in front of them. And it started permeating, coming down the path at a low level. At this point, Mrs. May was at a fence. And basically what it was, Tim, it was a fence that was between 3 and 4 foot high. And there were posts to the left and right. And Mrs. May told me that back then, there was just big posts with these slats that were nailed from left to right. So they had to climb over this.
Mm-hmm.
Now you have the second one. This is another obstacle. They start climbing over this fence, the first people. and the rest of them are strewn out behind like a wagon train.
Right, right.
So at this point, you had Mrs. May, Gene Lemon, Neil Nunley, Eddie May, and Ronald Shaver.
Plus the three dogs.
And there's one dog.
Oh, okay, okay.
Okay.
The other one's bailed.
The other two dogs neglected to go any further. They wouldn't go past that fence.
Right.
The collie went ahead. So we have all the adults up front leading the path, and you have this sickening sulfur smell permeating down the path. Now, it's what Mrs. May told me. It's a slang word. She said there's a swag in the path. And I was never up there with Kathleen because she was physically incapable of going up there.
Right.
But I was up there several times with Freddie May.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what happened is as the collie went ahead, it started barking and it disappeared and it went into this. It was like a misty smoke.
Oh,
it was tearing ass up around the swag, and it went straight up. And it basically disappeared because of this swag. It swings to the left.
Mm-hmm.
And this whole time you're walking uphill. Freddie May, Teddy Neal, and little Tommy Heyer had reached that wooden fence. And they were just starting to climb over it. They never passed it. And the rest of the group is moving up ahead. All of a sudden the dog starts barking its ass off. It takes off and lets out a yelp, and it runs back, and it runs past Mrs. May Lemon and all the boys, runs, and it jumps through the fence, because the dog could get through
right,
it,
right, yeah.
And it ran past Freddie, Teddy, and Tommy Heyer, and it went back to the house. So, and,
oh, my God.
And, you know, I'll kind of jump ahead a little bit.
Okay.
Ivan Sanderson reported that dog was found dead the next day on the veranda of somebody's porch.
Oh, God.
So, anyways, Mrs. May and Lemon, they're leading the pack, and the rest of the boys are strewn out in this wagon train, and Mrs. May and Gene Lemon each had flashlights. Lemon had a flashlight because he lived in the neighborhood, and he would walk back and forth and visit Mrs. May and the kids. And you always had a flashlight in West Virginia walking through the woods up there.
Yeah.
Mrs. May had a flashlight. Her and Lemon are walking side by side. Mrs. May is to the left-hand side of the path closer to the woods. Lemon's towards the outside, and the other boys are behind him. Mrs. May told me she heard this noise that sounded like a thumping noise, and it was basically, as she described it, it was like a stretched canvas, kind of like a drum.
Okay.
Like a tom-tom drum, and she heard this thumping, repetitive thumping. And she heard this noise that was like a hiss noise that sounded like air escaping from something. And as she started moving a little bit closer, to the left of her, there was this gigantic white oak tree. And it was set about 4 feet off to the left. And there's a little incline. There's a little roll there. It's not all level. And as Mrs. May started nearing this area, this is where it became a little bit thicker. Where this was the point where this sulfur mist, it was like a gas, was emanating from, and it's coming from behind this tree area. Well, as Mrs. May started walking a little closer towards this tree, it set about 4 feet back. Lemon was behind her. They looked up, and about 12 feet up in the air, they noticed these two glowing eyes. They thought it was actually, because it was up that high, they thought it was some type of an animal perched up on a branch,
yeah.
12 feet up in the air. It's
right.
Like, what the hell else is going to be 12 foot high way up there? Plus, you have about a 3 or 4 foot incline. So these eyes are up pretty high up in the air. So as they neared this, they clicked on their flashlights, and they pointed their flashlights up into the woods. And it's about dusk now, and it was a little darker in the wooded area off to their left. And as they flashed the beams hit up into that area, Tim, this thing lit up. And Mrs. May told me it lit up like a Christmas tree. It illuminated from the inside. And this is what your Flatwoods monster was. It was a 12-foot-tall metallic-like structure.
Hmm.
The thing actually had lifted off the ground. It was a hovercraft. And this hovercraft was actually, the propulsion system was the gas and the air and the hissing noise that was escaping from this craft, lifted off the ground about a foot and a half, and it came down the 4-foot incline and crossed over the path in front of them. Gene Lemon freaked out. He, Mrs. May's exact words, she said, his legs got rubbery. And he passed out momentarily, and he hit the ground.
Oh, God.
To Mrs. May's right. It just freaked the hell out of him. Mrs. May is standing there, and this thing hovered. She froze for a second, paralyzed in fear. The other kids kind of froze for a second. This thing scared the hell out of them. And it moved across in front of Mrs. May. It moved in front of Lemon. And it kept going off to the right. And it passed in front of Neil Nunley. And this thing actually moved across the path. And it went down into the gully, the valley to the right, where the craft was sitting off in the distance.
Right. Now, this thing you're describing, this is the infamous picture, right, that looks like some kind of entity of sorts?
That is the incorrect picture.
Okay.
Okay, that was kind of like the fable picture.
Okay.
That was drawn incorrectly. That's the ridiculous picture that's been shown for years.
Okay.
Being an illustrator, I was able to sit down with the witnesses,
mm-hmm.
and get the stories from them, and I worked with them. We'll get to that in a minute. So what happened is this thing is passing by in front of Mrs. May. It's actually splattering out this, like, blackish-gray oil.
Oh, God.
This thing was a machine, and it was splattering this stuff out, and it hit the front of her, and it hit some of the boys up that were up close to it, the ones that were right almost on top of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to get an idea of how close Kathleen was to this, and Lemon, and Mrs. May said she was close to it as a car. And then she paused and she said, a small car. So this thing was approximately 15 feet away from her. And when I was playing the devil's advocate with her at first, during the first interview I did with her, and I wanted to know how long she saw this thing and if she got a good look at it. And she says, I got a good enough a look at it where I could sit down and we could start drawing pictures. And I started drawing pictures with her. She saw this thing basically up close and personal. This thing was almost on top of her. And I remember her saying it was close enough to me that it splattered oil all over the front of my uniform.
Yeah.
She was in a close proximity to it. What was cool about working with Kathleen and her son, Freddie had reached the gate. Remember I just mentioned that?
Mm-hmm.
He never crossed over it. He saw the whole thing fold out in front of him.
Right, from a distance, yeah.
From a distance, which was just, we measured it, it was just over about 30 feet. And so when I was working with Kathleen and working with Freddie, she was giving me the up-close and personal descriptions of what this thing looked like. And she said she can actually feel heat from it.
Oh, boy.
And when I was doing my illustrations, which you could see online, and it's the cover of the book, Freddie was in the back. And
okay.
He was there with Tommy and Teddy Neal, so he saw everything unfold. So he gave me descriptions from his point of view.
Now, did she, A, save the uniform, or B, was there any sort of indication from, you know, from what got on her uniform as to, you know, what that stuff was at all?
She got back to the house, and she had taken the uniform off, and it was splattered. The kids had this crap all over their faces, and it had hit on parts of their clothing, too.
Mm-hmm.
And, well, what happened is when they all turned and ran,
yeah,
Mrs. May, and this is a key point of how scared she was, she said she passed several little boys on the way down. She said when she reached that gate, the wooden fence,
mm-hmm. yeah.
The second one, just before they got up there, she said she hurdled it in one bound.
Wow.
And that was between 3 and 4 feet high. And today they actually left that the posts up there. And I've been taking video footage for years up there. And it is about 3.5 to 4 foot high. I can actually see where the old nails were in there. And then, you know, I videotaped and took pictures of all of this.
Yeah.
So she did scale that. She hurdled it in one shot. And she told me I passed several of the boys on the way down. That's how scared she was back to the house. And the dogs and Freddie and the other kids had taken off. So they kind of had a head start. And they had to get back over the fence, the big metal fence, and none of them opened it up. They just kind of like the little kids crawled through it, the adults climbed over it.
Yeah.
They were so scared out of their wits when they saw this thing. They didn't have time. They just climbed over it, through it. They ran through it. The dogs jumped through it. They were climbing. And when they hit that open pasture, they were gone.
Yeah.
And they just tore ass back to the house. And when they got in there, some of the kids had fallen down, and they were cut up, and they were bruised because, you know, they fell going down the path. And
they
were
just
frantic. So Mrs. May's mom was tending to the boys. Her dad was there, and he was helping out. And Gene Lemon, he got a real hell of a good whiff of this this sulfur smell. And Kathleen May said he was just throwing his guts up.
Oh, God.
For a long time, and it affected him pretty well. And the kids were all coughing and gagging and wheezing. So that thing screwed him up pretty bad, Tim.
Yeah.
And they were trying to make sense of this thing. And, you know, you could just imagine the pandemonium that was going on in that house. And in the meantime, there was a posse that was getting together, and the word started traveling around throughout the area. And Mrs. May called the local sheriff's department, and Sheriff Carr wasn't in. He was around chasing objects that were repeatedly crashing through Flatwoods area and going into an area of Sugar Creek and Frametown down the Elk River, approximately 15 to 20 miles away. And what that was actually another damaged UFO. And we could get back into that a little bit later because all of this is, there's so much that happened that night. But basically, there was supposed to be a rendezvous in Flatwoods between two damaged craft.
Ah.
And what happened is the rendezvous was missed. This is all calculated and figured out, Tim, over years.
Oh, I'm sure, yeah.
Of all my documentation.
Yeah.
And I was able to speak to some of the locals who were alive back then in the early 90s. I got local newspapers. And when I really got rocking and rolling into this thing, the people were supporting me like crazy, and they were giving me articles. They still give me articles and mail me stuff, but the locals were, like, giving me stuff and check this out. And so this whole community that was had me at bay for a while has opened up to me all of a sudden. So now I have this gigantic puzzle with all of these pieces, and I'm trying to sort it together. I reviewed some of Gray Barker's notes in Ivan Sanderson, and I'm taking all of this information, just throwing it into one pot and trying to make sense out of it. And it did drive Sanderson, and especially Gray Barker, crazy trying to figure out what had happened, because there were so many UFOs that were seen over Flatwoods.
Mm-hmm.
And that Braxton County region, they couldn't figure out why so many people were describing different crafts. And these crafts were seen up close and at low levels, Tim.
Yeah.
And some of them were like 60-foot long cigar-shaped objects that looked like jets with no wings. There were oval-shaped objects. There were round-shaped objects. There was another round-shaped object that had a flat side to it. So you have a variety of different crafts there. And when Barker started looking into this more in depth, he just couldn't figure it out. Why are these people all describing these different crafts when there was only thought to be one that had crashed that had the Flatwoods Monster, the occupant of the damaged craft? And it turned out it was a search and rescue mission. And I actually tracked these UFOs coming in to that area. And there were some that came up from the southern part of the United States, and the other ones actually flew over Washington, D.C. and Virginia and flew in west. And every time I would do a book signing, I would go up there, and Stanton told me this was going to happen over the years. People would stand in the corner, and they would wait till the crowd leaves and the autograph people, and they would walk up to me, and these old-timers would walk up to me, and they would start telling me these stories.
Yeah.
And it's embedded in my head because I've been doing it for so many years. And these people were lived in Braxton County and other counties, and they were talking about seeing these different crafts flying at low level. And I would just pull my map out, and it's connecting the dots. It was seen here, 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 and here.
Yeah. Well, it's
interesting. I traced them back to Washington, D.C. So these craft actually had come in over Washington, D.C. and headed west and went in looking for it.
That's just crazy. Now, I'm looking at your website here, flatwoodsmonster.com, and I see the cover of the book. And so that's what we're seeing, what I'm seeing, what folks can see at flatwoodsmonster.com on the cover of the book. That's more of an accurate depiction of what these kids and Kathleen saw that night, as opposed to the black and white drawing that's so infamous.
Right, right. And the reason for the nickname of the Green Monster, mm-hmm, is it was actually, Tim, it was like an aluminum gray color. It, mm-hmm, wasn't super shiny, according to the witnesses. But what had happened is this thing, according to the witnesses, says it had some type of an interior lighting system. And it lit up from the inside. And when the flashlights from Lemon and May's flashlights, when the beams hit this thing, the thing lit up. And it reflected the green from around it.
Okay, yeah.
It was an Indian summer, and the leaves hadn't changed yet. So you have all the green around from the shrubbery, from the trees, the foliage, the grass, and everything. And it actually reflected the green, plus this thing lit up from the inside. So you have two different light sources.
Right, right.
Reflecting, that's why they called it the Green Monster. It wasn't really green. It was an aluminum color.
Right, and it wasn't even really a monster. It sounds like this was more, as you said earlier, sort of a hovercraft. This is more
it was actually
like a skate pod or some kind, or something
exactly.
like that.
Exactly. You know? It was a craft, and there is a million and one different write-ups of what was found, the trace evidence in the field. There were two paths. The locals up there from the get-go called them skid marks. What they actually were, there were two paths, and these paths were parallel, and they ran over to the area where it was pressed down, where the craft had sat down, after relocated into the gully. And when Stanton Friedman was there from the first time, the 50th anniversary, we went up there, he just stood there, and he was totally amazed, because when you stand there on a property and you look, this thing had landed on the high point in the pasture, and then it relocated, and it was, you know, tucked away in the corner so it wouldn't be seen, because this thing was glowing and flashing. Mm. You don't want to be sitting on a mountaintop.
Right, it's kind of high.
Glowing. Up. Yeah, so it's tucked away there. Well, what happened is there was one set of tracks coming out from the craft area across this gully. It went up the incline. It went across the path up to the tree. And when this thing departed, it followed like snow print, footprints in the snow. It followed a parallel path back to the craft. And the path, each one was approximately 4 foot wide. What this monster was, for lack of better words, was actually a hovercraft. Remember Mrs. May said it hovered a foot to a foot and a half?
Right.
There were actually rocks that were blown over inside the path. And the grass was pushed over, and it was likened to like having a gigantic leaf blower and walking through this high grass that was like knee to waist high, just walking one direction and then moving back away from the tree again. And that was a parallel path that went. The locals called them skid marks. They were actually, it was actually grass, and this was like a hovercraft vehicle that blew this grass to pieces and shook everything inside of it.
Well, looking at this new drawing of the craft, it's remarkable the arrogance of the skeptics who say these people just saw an owl. It's like there's no way you could confuse what's drawn here with an owl. That's just not even possible. It's amazing.
Well, what happened, the whole myth of the monster came about with the drawing is Mrs. May was contacted by NBC Studios in New York, and there was a show back then called We the People, and Daniel Seymour was the host of the show. It started out as a radio show, then it became a radio and TV show, and they would have different guests on there. Well, this story hit so fast and furious around the United States, Mrs. May was contacted and invited to go to New York, and it was kind of like a talk show.
Yeah.
And Mrs. May, Ailey Stewart Jr., who was the co-owner of the Braxton Democrat with his dad, and he was in the Air Force. He was a vet in Korea. He got invited, and Gene Lemon. They all went to New York on September 19th. They flew out of Charleston. They went into the city, and they were to be interviewed for that. It was exactly 1 week later on September 19th. Well, they all go into the studios, and I work with Ailey Stewart very close to. He was kind of the backbone of the story because he broke the story to the press through the Charleston Gazette. I actually went up to his home when he was alive, and I stayed there for a whole weekend, about 3 days, and I just hung out with him, and we went over the story, and I interviewed and I taped them. So he kind of set the backbone of the story because his newspaper was the hub.
Right.
And they had received telephone calls, and there was correspondence from countries from all over the world. It was amazing. I have newspaper articles in different languages. I have a collection of Flatwoods Monster articles from around the world, and people still send me stuff too, Tim. It's amazing.
Amazing, yeah. That's
how far this story had reached. It was even in military paper, Stars and Stripes in the Pacific. Somebody sent me an article a couple years ago from that. So this story basically had hit into Japan and Asia and was in Europe just in a few days.
It was
unbelievable how far reaching this was. Mrs. May even got a call from a guy who was stationed in Japan. He actually called their house.
Jeez.
Because when this story hit on the news wires and it was read in the Stars and Stripes, it was a guy who actually lived in Braxton County, and he read this in the paper, and he heard about it in the media, and he called back there.
My God.
So it was really far-reaching. So Ailey Stewart was a key part of this whole thing, and he was actually the first one there on site after going to the May's house. He got the call to go up there from the state police because the sheriff's running around looking for crashed things, you know, going through the mountains. He's driving around like a nut. And what had happened is it was actually the same object was puddle jumping and crashing throughout Braxton County. So he would get a call and report. He would go to point A. Nothing.
It was already
there.
Off to point C or something, yeah.
Right, and he kept going back to the police department and like, oh, guess what, we got another call. So then he's going out to point B and back, and he's driving back and forth going nuts, going, what the hell's going on here?
Yeah.
And I actually retraced the sheriff's path. I went up with a friend of mine years ago, and we timed how far it was because this is all documented from point A to B to here, back and forth and back and forth. And we clocked our mileage, how long it took. So that's when I wrote the book. I figured out the timeline of everything around there, of what was going on. Then I interviewed another fellow, Jack Davis, who saw the craft coming in from a different part, and he was an adult. So I have all these different people coming forward and telling me stuff. So I'm plotting all these points all over, driving all over, putting my story and timeline together. And Stewart had actually received a call from the West Virginia State Police to go up there because the local sheriff wasn't there. The word spread around pretty quick. Now, Stewart was a photojournalist, and he was contacted by the state police because they couldn't get there either. We don't know why they couldn't get there. You know, that's one thing that Stewart told me when I interviewed him. He says, I don't know why they couldn't get there. All I was told is get your rafts up to the May house because something happened up there. The lady called, Mrs. May, and there's a, her and a bunch of kids are hysterical. Go check it out.
Right.
So he was friends with the police department because he would go to the different scenes with the police. Being a photojournalist, he had a killer camera. So he would take pictures of the crime scenes, accidents. So he was pretty tight with the police. So he actually represented the police department. So he went up there and he walked into the house. He was like the first person of authority in the house, and he described to me the pandemonium of what was going on in that house. He said it was hysterical.
I can imagine.
He said, not in a funny way, right?
You
know, he said the kids were freaking out and crying. He said Mrs. May, her eyes were all red and they were tearing and weepy. Some of the kids were bleeding because they had fallen down. They're freaked out. Now, in the meantime, you have all the locals getting together because the crap hit the fan, small little community. They want to know what's going on. So they form a posse. Now you have a whole bunch of armed men, including Stewart, and he told me he always carried a handgun and one or two shotguns and a rifle with him because, you know, when you're covering stories up there,
yeah,
you go
you
to so many collars, you don't know what you're going to run into. And Stewart and Mrs. May's dad and a bunch of the local guys were going to go up and check out and see what happened. Here's all of their kids are all messed up, and they want to know what the hell's going on back there. And in the meantime, the kids are starting to tell Stewart what they had seen. So, you know, that was kind of disturbing. So Stewart gets together with his posse, and they all go up to the farm. Now they have to get somebody to show them where it happened because now it's pitch dark.
Right.
And you're walking up into those mountains there, and they had a lot of nerve to do that. And they had what Stewart called electric lanterns. And they were like big, giant flashlights, like lanterns, kind of like what they would use in mines. And he told me they got the oldest boys together. And he said, he didn't tell me in too much detail, but he said one of the boys, he grabbed them by the back of the collar. And he said he was crying like a whipped pup.
Yeah.
He was like a little squirrel girl. This kid was shitting his pants. He did not want to go up there. He was shaking.
Yeah.
You can't blame the kid. I wouldn't want to go back up there.
Believe
either.
Me, I'm 34 years old. If it happened to me, I'd be shitting my pants too. So
yeah,
no harm on that guy.
And he said he was crying like a whipped pup. And he basically dragged him up the hill by the scruff of the neck. And, you know, they're trying to comfort this guy. You know, here's like half of the town is going up there with shotguns and, you know, rifles, handguns. So they all work their way up. They go up into the area. And as they got closer up and just past the area where the wooden fence was, they got across there and they started noticing the smell.
Okay, yeah.
And Stewart knew about how gas settled from being in the war, that chemical warfare and whatnot, that the gas settles. So he told me he got down on his hands and knees, and he was smelling this sulfur crap that was across the whole area. And he said, this is the smell that they were describing. He said he looked down and he scanned his electric lantern to the right, and he saw the big, gigantic marks, the two paths I mentioned
earlier,
going out into that area. And he said as he was walking through the area, they just stayed for a little while because, and this is what he says, we were not inclined to hunt for something in the dark that we didn't know what it was.
Yeah, especially if it came from space. You don't know what you're
going to do. Yeah, so, you know, at this point, they don't know. The kids didn't want to stay up there, the older boys, so they kind of hightailed it out of there, and they went back to the house. So all these different points of the story, Tim, is what I'm getting at, is I worked with all these individuals.
Right. I mean, this is
exclusive interviews from Stewart, from Mrs. May, from Freddie, I had talked to Mr. Shaver. I met Freddie's brother, Eddie. His name is Edison.
Mm-hmm.
I met all these key players. I worked with Jack Davis. He saw the craft coming in. And then I have all the past investigations from the early 50s. And most of those people are dead, so I had to go on a lot of their data, and it just was like one gigantic jigsaw puzzle trying to put everything together. But eventually I did it, and I tightened it up. And since the book was released last year, I found out more information. And I'm just piecing it together and piecing it together over the past year, and that's why I have this expanded version that's out. It's probably the most definitive investigation into not only Flatwoods, but probably just about any case.
It
was so well documented back then, and it got forgotten about. Everybody made fun of it. And as I'm going along, and I found more information out since this book came out.
Oh, I'm sure.
I got more stuff, you know, and it's doing shows like this and being in the media, you know, doing book signings and travel and doing radio shows and this and that. People contact me and they're sending me stuff. Give me your address. I got stuff. You wouldn't believe this stuff people send.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so it's like, oh, my God, here we go. Here's more stuff. Here's going to be another revised edition.
Right,
OG ready. He turns on the rubber, the 2-2 home. Swing and a miss, he struck him out. The 2013 Red Sox are the world champions, and Boston strong.
You're listening to Banal of America Audio.
Bedlam at Fenway Park as the Red Sox clinch the World Series at Fenway for the first time in 95 years. From last to best, the Red Sox have won their third world championship in 10 years.
Well, it's interesting how the name kind of, in a way, hurts the case in some instances because, like, you know, I saw you guys did the Monster Quest show. It's like, this isn't really a monster. It's just got the name Monster, but we're talking about more of a straight-up sort of UFO encounter without a creature that we know of, right?
Right, right. And what happened is, where I jumped off tractor a few minutes ago, is when Mrs. May, Jean Lemon, and Stewart went to New York. They sat down with a sketch artist.
Hmm.
And Lemon and Mrs. May are trying to describe this thing. Now, you know, these people live in central West Virginia. There was only like one or two cars up in the whole area, and Stewart owned one of them. And then there was the police car. These people basically lived off the land. It was a poor area. And even when I started going up there in the early 90s, Tim, it kind of looked the same way as it did back then once you get into those backwoods.
Hmm.
But eventually the McDonald's, Kentucky Fried Chickens, and Dairy Queen start all popping up there. And right now, you wouldn't even recognize it. But I was lucky enough back then to have videotaped the whole area before everything got built up.
Yeah.
And I have video footage of that farm before it got bought out and turned into a dude ranch, and it's all beautiful now. But I have the original shots from the early 90s and the tree that had decayed and fallen apart.
Yeah. Now, can people – so it sounds like you can't just go there anymore and check it out.
No. They actually have guards up there on the property now.
You'd think they'd some enterprising soul would have opened it up to –
Yeah, a doctor owns the property, and he works with us well if we have to get up there to do a TV show. But, you know, I can't blame the guy. You don't want people tromping around your property going up there. We've done some different little get-togethers where we had access to go up onto the property. But back to the drawing, Tim, is the sketch artist sat down with Mrs. May and Lemon, and Stewart was in the background, kind of overseeing this whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, okay, what did this thing look like? And these people are trying to describe this structure that looks like nothing they had ever seen, or anybody for that reason that
right,
I know
right.
of, and never seen anything like this. And they're trying to describe this thing, and the sketch artist is doing this picture, and Mrs. May's trying to describe the lower torso to this thing. And how she's trying to describe this, they're actually pipes that are running around a lower circumference. They're vertical pipes that was part of the exhaust. That's where the gas was shooting out. It was a hovercraft, and that's why the thing lifted. The original drawing shows a representation of the drop cast shadow, and that is correct because if you look at the original picture, you see it floating in the shadow underneath that was representing this thing's off the ground. But what Mrs. May was trying to get across to this guy, and it just missed, she was trying to describe these big pipes around the lower torso, and they reminded her of the drapes hanging in her living room.
Right. I was going to say, it looks like something wearing a dress or a,
right,
like
which
an
were
old librarian.
which were rolled. When I talked with Kathleen, she told me, no, it was metallic. It wasn't cloth, but she was trying to get something, you know, as close to what she could recognize this as. And when I was working with Freddie and doing all the thumbnails and comprehensive sketches, I remember sitting in his living room in Gasaway, and he said what Mother was trying to describe were pipes. And he held his arm out, and he said they were about as thick as my arm, my forearm. He said, and they were metallic too. And he said they went around the whole lower circumference. He said they were about as thick as a fireman's hose. And they were all spaced equally around the lower portion. From the waist up, this thing had actually tapered to the shoulders. On location at the site, Freddie actually took me step by step. We started out at the school playground. And some of this can be seen on the YouTube interview, and we went from the school playground up to Depot Street, up to the house, and we walked the exact path step by step with my cameras, and I videotaped them along the way. That's how I was able to tighten this whole timeline up and series of events of what happened.
Right.
Was because Freddie walked with me actually several times, and Freddie stood on site where the tree was, where he saw his mother and Gene and the older boys up front, and he said this thing was about 4 feet across at the base, and it tapered, and at the shoulder area, it was about 3 feet wide. Now, what the original sketch artist had drawn is like this hooded cape thing going over the top that looked like an ace of spades. Freddie said it wasn't a hood. And Kathleen told me also, they said it was an outer helmet. And the face of the monster was not a face. It was an inner helmet. And the head actually sat on this collar that was a couple inches high. So it was actually rotating around almost like a crystal ball sitting on a pedestal. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I'm looking at the picture from your book, and our good buddy Alfred Lemberg has posted a picture also in the chat room of it. So,
oh, cool.
Yeah, so folks listening live can follow along.
And Freddie and Kathleen both told me about the size of the eyes. Now, they weren't eyes. What Freddie really was adamant about, he said, Frank, he said they were portholes. The press reported them as eyes and bloodshot eyes, and the story just got carried away.
Right, right. Started
and,
to get and more and more.
The whole thing was a joke, but they were portholes. And when Mrs. May and Gene had hit this thing with the beams of light, it lit up. And one of the first times I interviewed Kathleen, I said, so did this thing actually react to you like it was intelligently controlled?
Right, I was just going to ask you that, yeah.
And Mrs. May said, yes, it responded to me. The second we hit that thing with the beams, it lit up from the inside. Now, what happened is there were beams of light that were actually forced out of the portholes. They weren't laser beams, you know, they weren't Buck Rogers laser beams that shot out.
It was like light came up inside and
forced light came out of it. And one time Freddie told me, he says, kind of is like looking at a car, all the lights inside your car at night, how they come out, you know, the dashboard displays and the digital. He says it kind of lit up like that from the inside. And these beams, they were actually weak. They went over the tops of their heads because this thing was twice the size of them. And one of the times up there I interviewed Freddie, he said, looking at this thing, you could tell from the reflections, he said there was like a plate glass window in front of it. There was like a facade that was attached to the helmet with this helmet, the outer helmet with the inner helmet. And it was kind of looking like at a fighter pilot sitting in the cockpit of his jet.
Mm. Now, do you
wearing
think,
his helmet.
Based on all your research, do you think this was sort of like an escape pod or maybe a beacon to call for help with people inside? What's your sort of take on what this, for lack of a better term, craft was?
Yeah, it was like a miniature hovercraft. Freddie told me that this thing, to him, was like a spacesuit. He said, Frank, this thing was a spacesuit. It was some type of a small mobile craft, and from what Mrs. May said, this thing reacted to her. Freddie believed that there was possibly something inside of it
okay. That
was controlling this thing.
Yeah, like maybe the thing was the main craft was damaged, so they kind of want to get out of there and figure
right,
out what
right.
to do.
And that's
and they can't
where
just
we,
walk around on Earth because they're presumably
right.
from another
yeah,
world.
It's, it's a hovercraft, and then we go back to what had happened 6 weeks prior, is when we had the where the Air Force had admitted with the flying saucers. This is the year of the saucers, summer of the saucers. They were seen just about every day over the United States. If you can't talk them down, shoot them down.
Right. That's how this all connects. That's the amazing
right.
stuff. Before we get to that, I just want to give you kudos. First of all, my style of show is when we get something really compelling like this, I just step back and let the expert go. And I got to give you credit, though, man, because I know without your work, this thing would have been lost to the sands of time, this whole story,
And it's amazing, too, Tim, because the answers are all out there.
Yeah.
It just took, it took 20 years of my life. It ate it up, but it was, it's interesting. I would do it over again, but everything is out there. I had no idea how big this story was back then. I read in a couple places it was estimated. Now, Flatwoods is a town of 300 people back then. Right now, there's about 400 there. It's a little community.
That's tiny, yeah.
There was approximately a guesstimate within 4 to 6 weeks after 10,000 people went there.
Oh, my God.
That's a lot of people. And Mrs. May was getting phone calls 24 hours a day from around the world.
Well, you got to give dubious credit then, I guess, to the powers that be, because if not, like I said, if not for you, this story would have been lost to the sands of time. So they did a pretty good job of, smothering the story.
Oh, absolutely. It's unbelievable. Intelligence was up there. They actually went up there. They were all, undercover. They were incognito. And I used a lot of Donald Kehoe's original quotes from his investigation of looking into the case. He did more of a governmental his research was into
right,
that,
right.
And from the higher up on the big boys in the Pentagon and a blue book right down. And he talks in his works how he was told through his sources at the Pentagon that there was a couple guys up there who posed as reporters. And then when I interviewed Mrs. May, she told me, and she never read Keogh's book. She didn't even know who Donald Kehoe was.
Yeah, yeah.
She didn't know who Ed Ruppelt was. That's, like way beyond. They had no idea how much this was covered. And at one point when I showed Mrs. May my 2-pound book with Project Blue Book,
yeah,
and I flipped open a page and I told her about how Chop had, at the Pentagon, had told Kehoe, it was probably an owl in a tree and all of that kind of crazy stuff. Mrs. May got upset, and she was really disappointed because she didn't know all of this stuff. And I said, Kathleen, this was heavily documented, and look at this. And it was called a meteor. The craft is called a meteor. And what I did is I worked outside of the Flatwoods area in my research, and I just kept expanding, like concentric circles.
Yeah.
Flatwoods was the bullseye. I kept expanding out, Tim. And I eventually found 116 locations throughout the United States where these things had flown and crash-landed. There was 4 damaged crafts that came in over the United States that night.
That night?
That night. And the majority of them were within a short time, within about a half an hour, and they crash-landed through the whole United States. I pinpointed every single location.
My God.
And documented every location. If you go on to flatwoodsmonster.com, you can see the master map that I worked with, and you can see the flight path trajectories. And I worked with different people over the years. I didn't do this on my own. I didn't figure all of this out on my own. I don't have a military background. But by working with military people, I've worked with retired sheriffs and deputy sheriffs and cops and military people. We figured this whole thing out. And what it basically was a search and rescue mission.
Yeah.
These things came in looking for it. And the cool part about it is, Tim, the majority of the documentation was right in Project Blue Book, and nobody saw it. It was hidden in plain sight. And
nobody,
you know,
saw it from the research community, presumably. But the powers that be probably kind of figured out what was going on.
Yeah, and I don't even know if they know.
That's true. Yeah,
because
there
was so much going on. I think it would have taken them over 20 years to figure out what was going on, you know, because I actually went to Tennessee. There was outside the Kingsport area in Arcadia, there was a UFO that had crashed down there, and I went into that area and documented that. There was 3 of them that came over the eastern seaboard. They were approximately 90 miles off the coast of the United States, and that is where the origin point was from. And one object had flown that was damaged. It flew down towards the southwest, and it was actually heading towards Oak Ridge National Laboratory, and it flew through the no-fly zone, Oak Ridge. The second one had flown in the other direction, and it headed northwest, and this object flew towards Wright-Patterson Air Force Base.
Oh, boy.
And it actually stopped short of Wright Pat, turned and redirected, and landed up in the West Virginia Panhandle, and en route to going up there, nearly collided with 2 passenger planes.
My God.
So it's all documented. It's all pieced together. The third object, Tim, flew straight down the middle, and it flew over Washington, D.C., and along its flight path trajectory, when it hit over the eastern seaboard and came in over Washington, it was actually flying at certain points at treetop level with pieces flying off of it and exploding.
Jeez.
And as it flew over D.C., all of this documentation is right in Blue Book. I couldn't believe what I was reading.
So what does it say in Blue Book? That these, essentially what you're telling me, that these unknown craft were flying...
This thing came in, and it was called the Flame Over Washington. And it was actually reported on September 13th in the New York Times, called the Flame Over Washington. And when this object flew over D.C., this was about 7 o'clock. There's people out driving around in their cars and convertibles. There's people walking their kids in strollers, walking their dogs. They're walking around Washington area. And here comes this thing flying just about a treetop level across Washington. It was seen by hundreds of people. It wasn't a little isolated incident. Well, what happened is when this thing flew over Washington, headed west, there was a series of UFOs that ascended, descended into the area of Washington, Virginia, and Maryland. And these UFOs formed a perimeter, an aerial perimeter, as they descended down over those 3 states, and they followed it west.
Yeah.
They were blocking for it. It's all in Blue Book. The answers are right there. Nobody ever pieced it together. I actually did a handmade map that was about 8 feet wide by about 6 feet. And I got maps of Washington. I worked a lot over Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University here in Daytona. I live right down the street from it, by the racetrack. And I spent years going over to Riddle, getting maps out and working with different people. And
I'm looking at one of these maps on Paratopia area. It's amazing. It's
and
the detail involved. I gotta stop you here, man. I'm just amazed. You're dedicated to this stuff, to this case and this story. It's amazing.
So what these UFOs did is they followed the damaged one until it reached over west into the Virginia area. And there was actually a pilot in a plane that flew real close to this thing and saw this fiery object flying by over Front Royal, Virginia. Well, after this thing got outside of Washington, D.C., over Virginia, heading west, it took a half an hour for it. From the point it flew over Washington, it flew about 200 miles west. It hit northern Braxton County in a little community called Burnsville. When it hit Burnsville, it redirected and headed south, and that's where it flew all the way further, deeper into Braxton County until it hit the center of Flatwoods, turned, and it landed up on the hill. It's pinpointed all across the country. The other UFOs had ascended back up into the sky. They went into the northern panhandle area where the other one had went down. They dropped out of the sky, Tim, for 2 hours looking for the other one that went down.
Jeez.
And that is documented very heavily in the press. And the Flatwoods Monster case, all the articles did not appear right off of the bat the following day because the story went in too late. Hmm. When I started looking at the following day, the event happened on September 13th. When I started looking into the following day's reports, I have all of these different articles about UFO scene and fireballs and stuff crashing around the United States. And I'm like, this is nuts. So that's what you're seeing there is those 116 locations on that master map where the UFOs flew. And they actually flew into the panhandle area, and they were flying and landing and touching down in the area of Pittsburgh, eastern Ohio, and that section up around Wheeling where the thing went down, and they were just dropping out of the sky for 2 hours, and the people were panicking.
I can imagine.
This is the summer of the saucers, and you have articles, you know, in that whole region up there talking about meteor showers. one of the objects in the Wheeling area actually touched down between the radio towers on top of a hill and landed and then ascended and took off again, just like a meteor would do.
Yeah, exactly. Now let's connect all this to the Air War 52, because that's what this is all about in a big way. You know, the events of the Flatwood Monster case were sort of the pinnacle of this shoot-them-down spree, if you will, right?
Right.
So I guess, you know, now just bear with me, because we're going to have Alfred calling in a few moments. But,
okay.
You know, give me sort of a short thumbnail on this shoot-down order. I mean, what have you uncovered on this, and how extensive was this? You know, how was this a one-off sort of thing? Was this a rare occurrence, or was this like an ongoing, frequent situation where pilots were encountering UFOs and trying to shoot
them? Like, we talked right before we went on the air, there was something that really tipped it all off, and I was starting to read through Ed Ruppelt's book,
mm-hmm.
The Report on Unidentifying Objects.
Right.
It came out in 1956, and there was another edition of it later. But it was documented, and I might as well read the quote straight out here instead of
mm-hmm.
just trying to edit it. This is what Ruppelt said in his book. Other assorted historians point out that normally the UFOs are peaceful. Gorman and Mantell, those are two other cases, just got too inquisitive. They just weren't ready to be observed closely. If the Air Force hadn't slapped down the security lid, these writers might have not reached this conclusion about being peaceful. There have been other and more lurid duels of death. Now, that's when the red flags went up. And I called Stanton Friedman up. I said, Stanton, you read this book. When's the last time you read it? And he said, it's been years. I said, do you remember this quote in there? And he says, not really. That was what we were talking, what you played at the beginning of the show. So we started looking into this a little bit deeper. Stanton started looking into it. He started making phone calls and get connections. And, you know, before you know it, we have all of this data and everything I could get my hands on. I have a massive UFO library with periodicals, newsletters. I have a storage unit filled with thousands of pieces, Tim.
Okay.
I don't have a couple. It's massive.
I can imagine.
I started going through this stuff, and I started pulling out different quotes and different people who had written about this over the years. And then I actually went over to a couple of local colleges here, and I started looking through the New York Times. I wanted to see if I can find anything else out about this quote. And I started finding all these articles about missing pilots. And to make a long story short, what I did not shoot them down, I went between 1951 and 56, and I wrote a chapter in there called The Six Deadly Years.
Yeah.
And between 51 and 56, the New York Times was chock full of all these mysterious disappearances and screwy-ass crashes with only interceptor jets. No mid-air collisions, no takeoffs, no landings. All of these things happened up in the air, and pilots were disappearing all over the United States. And during that time, that is when I kept looking further, and I found the International News Service report from Tuesday, July 29th. Air Force orders jet pilots to shoot down flying saucers if they refuse to land. And the quote is, Lieutenant Monsell Mont's information officer stated, the jet pilots are and have been under orders to investigate unidentified objects and to shoot them down if they can't talk them down. And that's
amazing.
Just one of them. I just came across another recent article, pilots ordered to shoot down saucers in range. It's an International News Service story, and it's from the Charleston Gazette. We have the San Francisco Examiner in California. Jets on 24-hour alert to shoot down saucers. And the further I look into this, the more I'm finding. Then we're finding out all about all these missing pilots. And Kehoe was looking into this very in-depth back in the early 50s. And he's got a lot of quotes about it. So what I did is I pulled all of these quotes together. I pulled all my statistics together, and from my New York Times case study, which is, I basically started post-World War II and went all the way up to 1959. This took years to do, and 51 to 56 had the most accidents.
Yeah.
And according to the New York Times, there was 205 fighter aircraft accidents where interceptors were destroyed.
My God.
And that's just a fraction of what actually was occurring.
Yeah, that's just what we know about.
Right, that's just what was reported. And what I noticed is when all of these things were starting to happen, there would be big front page articles. Jets would mysteriously crash into towns and cities. And, I mean, people were getting killed. Little kids are in the backyard playing. It was horrible shit. The gasoline is spraying and burning little kids.
Oh, geez.
I mean, it's nutty. Just planes dropping out of the sky. And they were front page. Then as I started going on, as I got closer to 56, there was still a lot of stuff going on, but they would be stuck in the back of the underwear ads for gimbals at the end of the paper.
Yeah.
And it would be like a two or three little liner. And I'm like, but it started out with these big articles, and then I started cross-referencing through all of my data and Blue Book. I mean, anything I could get my hands on, I was cross-referencing, and I had these massive charts and all my data together, And a lot of these locations where the jets were going down and vanishing, there were also flying saucers seen in the area. And this is what I put together. Since then, I have also been working on and what I call my master book. I put together a book, and it's called Duels of Death. And I have every single thing that happened to do with jets and UFOs documented for a 10-year period, Tim.
My God.
And I have that book sitting on the back burner. The Shoot Them Down book is just 52. I cover a 10-year period from 47 to 57 of everything. It's a massive book.
That's amazing. Let me just jump in here because we got Alfred on the line. I've
had him
on
great.
For like 5 minutes, so I want to bring him
okay.
in here. All right. Alfred, what's going on, buddy? We got you in on the conversation now.
Okay, real good. Do I have to turn off anything over here? I can just leave everything the way it is. Are we cool?
I suppose so. If you got the show playing, you can shut it off in the background because now you're part of the show, so you don't need to listen. You're living the experience.
Hey, Al, how you doing?
Right,
loud and clear.
Pretty good, buddy. Yeah, Art Bell is always saying, turn off your radio, and I was wondering if I had to do that over here. Hey, real quick and dirty, because I know you guys want to get on with some other, you know, going back to the very beginning when this the Flatwoods affair initially started to kick off and everything, it's been debunked and very religiously, vociferously, and nastily debunked by persons of the caliber of, say, Dr. Immaterial Joe Nichols, for instance, right? And they're all very fond of coming up with these different excuses of what it could have been, like a geological gas in the area because of the makeup and the coal stratas of West Virginia, this, that, and the other thing, and another one is seasonal plants that made the kids sick and made them see funny things, and then finally that last one, which was a demonstration that the people of Flatwoods, who had been living with the flora and fauna of that area for many hundreds of years, probably knew something about owls and what they're supposed to look like.
Yeah.
So all of that is just all of the discussions about debunking the whole Flatwoods affair on those scores have been proven completely ridiculous. A MUFON star team. Geologists went up and checked out for the difficulty
with the
geology in the area, and gave it a clean bill of health. Said there's not the kind of necessary formation in that area that would make gas and what have you. But what we have to remember is that whatever occurred, whatever's true, it never happened before, and then it never happened again. So, what's up with that? There really had to be something going on up there.
Yeah.
Frank talks about, tracking the UFOs and that he was very assiduous. And you see the picture of the map where the UFOs are tracked, and the listener might ask the question like, hey, how do you do that? What's the function of tracking UFOs and putting them on the map and everything? And simply, all it was from named reports and official reports and Project Blue Book, you get time signatures, you get bona fide witnesses, first person witnesses who witness these things, and you were able to establish them to a timeline and see which way these aircraft are going and what have you. But I want to finish up here real quickly by saying that everybody needs to remember and it's too easy to think that the Flatwoods affair might have been an isolated incident. That it happened once to some kids and some people up there in the hills of West Virginia, and it doesn't account for much. But what everybody has to remember is that first we had the summer of saucers in June, July, and August. And the Summer of Saucers was the biggest UFO flap in United States history. On top of that, the United States government, I would assume, decides that they want one of those puppies, and they issue the military orders to shoot them down. And it's pretty much shoot on sight. There's a little codicil in there about, if we can't talk them down, then we'll have to shoot them down. No, all that's for the lawyers. All that's for the lawyers. Right. All of that's for the lawyers. It was shoot them down. Now, following that, the shoot down orders, we have September 12th rolls around where we have 21 and a half continuous hours of distressed UFOs flying around, landing, taking off, smoking, very acrid, smelly smokes, making sounds in the air like they're distressed. And then following that, you have Flatwoods, the end of the story. And none dare call it an undeclared secret war with E.T., but, what's it sound like to you? Over to you, Frank.
Yeah, exactly. And,
yeah,
and
absolutely.
What's interesting about it, too, I'm not going to let you go just yet, Alfred, so let me know when you got a bail on me. But what's interesting, too, there is that, you hear about the stories of the shoot. I've always heard the shoot them down stuff, but you always kind of think that I'd always thought that it was sort of a one-sided affair, that we couldn't handle the UFOs, and that's why we lost all these pilots. But based on what we're learning here tonight and what we've learned from Frank's research, that clearly we were getting getting shots in. We were winning small skirmishes, apparently, if there were these UFOs going down.
Yeah, and then when you throw into the mix what the United States had, but what the government had developed, was the F-94 C Starfire. And that had the AR rockets, the foaming fin aerial rockets. They were 2.75-inch rockets. They had a 7.5-pound warhead. And they were about 4 feet in length. They weighed about close to 20 pounds. And these babies traveled at 2,500 feet per second. And add that on to a jet flying, over 600 miles an hour, which was about their capabilities back then. We also had the F-86D Sabre Dog, and that carried 24 rockets in a lower body in an elevator. It was, it would lower down, it would fire the rockets out, and the Navy had the F-7U-3 Cutlass, and that carried the rockets in a pod. We had the capability, and we were using them, chasing flying saucers and shooting at them with rockets. Now, that would have been a nice surprise to UFOs who were used to dodging bullets because we were shooting at them. This is documented.
Yeah.
I have several cases pulled out and put aside. I could give them to you, but I'd have to dig through all my notes, where it's documented how they were chasing and firing at these UFOs. And this is all in Project Blue Book.
Yeah.
So what we have here is these three rocket-bearing jets chasing flying saucers and UFOs. These particular UFOs came in over the eastern seaboard. Three of them were damaged. I have even went to the extent where I have taken these different objects and I figured out their flight paths and have the exact locations where they touched down. We had the one that went down in Tennessee, the one that flew over Baltimore and crash-landed up in the West Virginia Panhandle, the one that went over Washington and crash-landed in Flatwoods. Then we have one that came up from North Carolina. The one that came up from North Carolina and route from Florida actually crashed 4 times. The one over Washington crashed 2 times. The one that flew over Baltimore 5 times, and the Tennessee one crashed 2 times.
Jesus.
So we have 4 damaged objects where I pinpointed, along their flight path trajectories, 13 landings. I don't want to run through all of them now, what we also have, too, is when I told you earlier where these UFOs were dropping out of the sky for 2 hours up in the Pittsburgh, eastern Ohio, and Wheeling, West Virginia area. They called it a meteor shower. There were actually 8 landing sites where those things were touching down and dropping in people's backyards.
My God. And
searching where that one went down. There was one landing site in West Virginia, 6 in Ohio, and 1 in Pennsylvania. And that was the story I told you where one dropped down between the radio transmitter towers and then took off. These things were going on all over the place. And I was able to establish that there was 25 different UFOs seen, as Alfred mentioned, 21 hours plus of sustained sightings on September 12th, 25 different craft. and I was able to differentiate by using the Blue Book documents and from the tentative observers witness questionnaires of what these things look like. They did drawings. Well, I did the same thing, except I put them into order. And there was all different shaped objects. There were saucers seen, the round-shaped objects, the ones that were jet-shaped objects, like cigar-shaped objects. And once you have a certain shaped craft and you see it over here, over Washington, then it's seen over Virginia, then it's seen here. And I tracked them going into Flatwoods. This was a massive search and rescue operation.
Now, Alfred, while I still have you here, you know, with the risk of embarrassing Frank for giving him too many kudos for his fine work, I think it's important to stress here the importance that there's still a lot of good information that we can dig out of these old cases, you know, as opposed to storming the gates of Congress in a futile attempt to get the government to reveal all of the UFO secrets. If we circle back and look at what information that we have available, clearly Frank has demonstrated that there is great stuff that can be gleaned from this information of the past that maybe people need to take a better look at, right?
In idle, casual readings, for instance, there is a much divested and completely discredited case called the Desvergers case. And roughly what we're talking about, you'll remember about the Boy Scout in Florida, our Boy Scout leader in Florida who had a raft of Boy Scouts with him, and they're driving home, and they see something from the inside of the car, and he stops the car to run over the Boy Scout leader, Desvergers. What's his first name, Frank?
Yeah, the West Palm Beach story.
Right.
Yeah, West Palm Beach. Yeah, that was in August, just a few weeks before the Flatwoods case.
Yeah, but see, the point is that that case was discredited until Frank found it in Blue Book, inexplicably after it was completely destroyed and washed away, and found the link up with the Flatwoods affair, giving credibility to both cases, because you see, the Desvergers case had interest from Blue Book the same way and in the exact same fashion that they did for the Flatwoods case. The only problem with the Desvergers case. But the only problem with the Desvergers case, remember, is that Desvergers thought he saw occupants in the craft that he saw. So naturally, you know, during that time frame, they didn't touch reports like that where people were actually seeing beings.
Right. Yeah, but it's amazing that there's such good stuff still out there that people, you know, that has fallen through to the sands of time, if not for the work of guys like Frank. So kudos to Frank.
Yeah.
When you look,
you find, and something else too. Going back to Flatwoods for a second, there was a small mention of Colonel Dale Leavitt and the what he had contributed to the affair and what was going on with him, and the reason I bring him up again is that Colonel Leavitt interviewed on tape, and you get his complete story. I mean, you know, the guy was there, was a bona fide United States Army hero of the Second World War, right? And he took a pretty heavy battalion of people up there into the hills along about the September 12th time frame. The point being is that you don't move a unit of that size or any unit into an
guys.
Area, right, 180 guys based on a couple of kids seeing ghosts up in the hills. You know what I'm saying?
Right, exactly.
It's just all of it's so completely nuts and so completely ignored when you have a situation where, and I don't mean this to belittle it at all, and it might sound like I'm getting ready to head off into that direction. I am not, but I'm talking about soldiers missing in action, just the way they were lost in Vietnam, just the way they're lost in Afghanistan, just the way they're lost in Iraq. Missing in action, soldiers, guys that were ordered into dark, stormy skies to battle UFOs. It boggles the mind.
It really does. It's amazing that it happened. It's amazing that it's been covered up for so long. You know, it's just absolutely remarkable. It's scary that they can get away with covering it up for so long. So.
Well, what I have here, what Alfred's talking about, and I'm just going to take a minute or so to run through this, Tim.
Okay, should we let Alfred go? You want to head out, Alfred?
It'd be cool if Alfred hangs out, because he's the one that brought this point up.
Okay, we got you.
What I found in the New York Times as I was going through, I found the different veteran combat fighters, and I found that there was 9 cases right off the bat where these veteran combat fighters disappeared into thin air or they crashed under mysterious circumstances. I'm going to run by from the top to the bottom how many combat missions these guys had.
Mm-hmm.
One had 182, one had 130, 105, 100, 185, 81, 70, and 32. Now, those are the top 9 guys, as reported in the New York Times. That's 9 guys who died, total 885 combat missions. That was between World War II and Korea. Some of them fought in both. 885 between 9 guys, and they vanished into thin air or they crashed under bullshit circumstances. All of this was covered up. And in a majority of these cases, we have UFOs and saucers seen in the same area. That's what I was able to piece together. And out of that crew there, we have 4 aces. One was a World War II ace. Then we have another World War II ace, a World War II ace, and we have a Korean ace who had 10 MiGs and 328 combat hours. These guys are just disappearing in a thin air and crashing. It was unbelievable.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's just the tip of the iceberg. There's a couple hundred of these cases. And when you look further into it, and you know, it would take a lifetime. There was thousands of these.
It's amazing. I mean, we've gone an hour and 50 minutes, and I feel like we've only scratched the surface on both of these stories. So I've already told Alfred off the air, the 3 of us are going to do a taped conversation sometime in the future to continue this, because mm-hmm. there's so much to talk about. It's really... it's just mind-boggling, as you said, the breadth of this wave of this secret war. It really was a secret war. It's amazing.
And it's all documented. It's all documented.
Yeah. In the not only in the Blue Book archives, but also in your in Shoot Them Down, right?
Right. And it's also been documented going back into the early works of Donald Keough and Stringfield. Those guys had touched on it. They started the ball rolling. And I have all of their old books, and they're all of their works, and that's what kind of put it together. But the Laura Duels of Death quote by Ruppelt is what really triggered this off.
Yeah, Lurid Duels of Death. That's,
there have been other more and Lurid Duels of Death.
That's a vivid language.
Mm-hmm.
Alfred, the website for you is alienview.net, right, buddy?
Yes, and from there you can find alienview.blogspot.com, I believe. Yeah.
There you go. All right.
At any rate,
Well, we're right up against the end here, so thank you, Alfred, for calling in and joining in. Like I said, we're going to do a longer version of this triumvirate of folks talking, me, you, and Frank. So,
looking forward to it, Tim, and we'll see you later, Frank.
Okay, thanks, Al. Have a good night.
Out here. Have a good night, buddy. Now, Frank, tell me a little bit about what you have coming up. As I said to Alfred here on the private chat, I wasn't trying to boot him. I was kind of keeping an eye out on his phone bill. I don't...
yeah, right.
And as I said, we're right up against the we're getting close to the hour here. So what's the time frame, I guess, on the book, this master book that you're working on?
Well, the book is basically finished. And I just finished putting out the expanded version of the Braxton County Monster, so I have that under wraps. And last month I flew out to Hollywood, and I was interviewed for the movie 701, the movie.
Mm-hmm.
It's a docudrama that's going to be released in the spring of next year. So I went out to Hollywood for a few days, and I was interviewed. And I met a bunch of the key players, Fox and Torme and Inez Romero. And from what I understand, there was over 40 people interviewed. And from what I was told, this is probably going to be the best UFO documentary / docudrama ever made. They went to the end of the earth, and there were people there from all over the world that were flown in for this. Hmm. I came in towards the end. I was one of the last persons interviewed, and I did about a two-hour interview. And I may be going back out there because they're going to be doing a reenactment, because this group of people is really on the ball. They want to get this thing right, unlike what the Monster Quest thing turned out to be.
Yeah, I don't even want to get into that. Next time we talk, we'll get into that, because I watched a little bit of that on YouTube today, and that was a cluster F. So.
Yeah, and what happened with that is Alfred went up to West Virginia, and I basically got to handpick my team. And I picked Stanton Friedman. I got one of the guys from the star team out of Pennsylvania. John Bainbridge came in. And Stanton, we had everybody there. We had, like, a great team. We did our jobs. We did, I don't even know how many hours, a shoot. We were up in the mountains. We were going about 16, 18 hours a day. And I never heard another word. And they never worked with me after they did the shoot. And when I saw the finished product on TV, I saw it when everybody else did. I almost fell over.
Yeah.
I'm like, I can't believe they did this after the work we did. I actually was there in the studio with Alfred where we did the shoot right after my interview. And the cutaway shots that you see during that show, during that same sequence, what we did, Tim, is they zoomed in and I actually went step by step across my master map.
Nice.
And I showed everything of what happened, because the official government explanation for all of these sightings is it was a meteor. And I showed on a map they never even used it. And that meteor was seen, the explanation through Blue Book was seen for an endurance of about 6 to 7 seconds.
Yeah.
Where when it flew over Washington, it took about a half an hour to fly to Flatwoods. It was over Washington about 7 o'clock and nearly 7:30. So it took a half an hour. The thing was flying about 400 miles an hour.
Jeez.
Not 26 miles per second. And that's what it was said to have flying. That meteor was going pretty quick.
Yeah.
It wasn't a meteor at all. And there was no meteor records anywhere on planet Earth about meteors or meteor showers on September 1252, except in Blue Book.
That's just unbelievable. It's unbelievable stuff. This is one of the downsides of the live show. We're running out of time. So I don't think I heard exactly when. What's your timetable on the master book with the 10-year?
I just got this thing out of the way, in California, and I was working with the people out there, so this is going to be my next focus, is this book, hopefully soon. Soon, Tim.
Nice.
We're
sounds good.
On it.
Yeah, I can imagine you probably want to catch your breath a little bit.
Yeah, exactly. It was a good trip, though. I'm impressed. I kind of saw everything from the inside out there and for that California trip. And there's some impressive cases and some really cool people involved in this thing.
And where can folks get the new book, the Braxton County Monster Updated and Revised Edition? Is that through Amazon or actually Lulu Shop? So just go to flatwoodsmonster.com. Right?
Yeah, go to flatwoodsmonster.com. And then if you actually, when you come down a few inches on there, you can actually see the YouTube piece that I put together. It's a 37-minute-long documentary, and some of the key people that I interviewed, Mrs. May and Colonel Levitt and Freddie May, you'll actually see highlights of the actual interviews when I tape them, and it looks pretty good. It's a nice little piece.
Nice.
And that's a link right on the website, too, and the book, you can get the book there.
All right. It sounds like this thing continues to grow, continues to expand. You're getting more and more information, so it took us way too long to get you on the show, and as I said, this is one of the rare times where we have the limitations of the live show, because I feel like we can keep talking for quite some time, and we will do so in the future. We will definitely have you back on the show. I want to get you and Alfred together for a show together and talk about this as well.
We can keep going.
Oh, absolutely, man, absolutely. I can't give you enough credit. I've just kind of stepped out of the way and just enjoyed listening to this stuff because it was just amazing. I got to give you just huge props, Frank, for doing the legwork on this and dedicating so much time. I mean, if only we had more guys like you, we might have cracked this case a long time ago.
Yeah, and I've said it for years, if the UFO community stuck together as tight as the skeptics have, this thing would have been solved years ago. But, you know, the UFO community isn't as tight in a lot of aspects as you would think. Everybody's looking for the smoking gun instead of working together as a team. You know, it's a shame.
Exactly.
If more people work together like the skeptics do, bashing everybody. Yeah, this thing would have been solved a long time ago. But I'm starting to see that happening. You know, a lot of the people are starting to work together.
Well,
Stan Friedman has been great working with me on this case.
Oh, Stan's the man. Stan is, you know, he's an icon. So.
Yeah, and guys like Alfred Lemberg, you know, hats off to Alfred. Alfred's been worth $1 million working on this project.
Absolutely.
And Alfred's been in Flatwoods several times, and so is Stan.
All right, well, we're at 20 seconds left, so I got to say goodnight to the live audience. I'll include the plugs for Banal of America stuff after that. But on that note, thanks for tuning in, folks. We got a whole new episode coming at you next week. And until then, have a good one, folks. All right. The live audience is gone, but let me throw in the plugs here for Banal of America for the folks listening on the MP3s. You can find out more about BOA at banalofamerica.com, BINNAL of America.com. Check us out on Facebook. Just punch in Banal of America. And I want to give props and congratulations to Con Anderson. He was like number 1099. Jeremy Bloxon was the long-awaited like number 1100. And Scott Bringhurst just missed the cutoff there. He was like number 1101. If you want to help out the program and keep us on the air, you can make donations via PayPal or our P.O. Box. All that information can be found at Banal of America. The next edition of the program will be coming at you on November 12th, 1 week from tonight. It will be a taped episode featuring Dr. Annie Kagan and Bill Guggenheim talking about after-death communication. I read the email from Mike and Ken about their outro song on the last episode and forgot to include it. So stay tuned in just a few moments and you'll hear the fancy outro song from Mike and Ken. And with all that said, thank you so much, folks, for tuning in. Thank you for your enduring support of Banal of America, and thank you for making BOA Audio a part of your esoteric audio playlist. Until next time, this is Tim Banal, thanking you for listening and signing off.